We come back to our chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga, the section on the Yoga of Divine Works. It's chapter 6, the ascent of the sacrifice to the works of love, the works of life. He is now talking about life. He touched upon the failure of the paths of renunciation to secure a victory for the transformation of life. They may deliver us to an experience of the inner spirit, but they do not satisfy the demand of life, that it be allowed, encouraged to reveal its fullness as an aspect of the divine being. So we have to push on and find a way to practice a yoga that doesn't kill us to the world, but joins us in a living way to the world. So he continues here, and there is a context, of course. He's writing in 1932. I never tire of saying that he's writing in 1932. And these revisions to the synthesis don't begin to see light, to see publication, until around 1946. What does get published is small collections of letters. The first, The Riddle of This World, in 1933, later, Lights on Yoga and Bases of Yoga. So, around the time that he is writing these chapters, or giving them a transformative touch, is when he's also having significant correspondence with a few people whose letters do get compiled into these small books. So let's look at some of that as we go along. We're at this paragraph now. A remedy, yet there should be and is a way of redress and a chance of transformation for this troubled vital nature. But for that, the cause of deviation must be found and remedied at the heart of life itself and in its very principle, since life too is a power of the divine and not a creation of some malignant chance or dark titanic impulse, however obscure or perverted may be its actual appearance. In life itself, there is the seed of its own salvation. It is from the life energy that we must get our leverage. For though there is a saving light in knowledge, a redeeming and transforming force in love, these cannot be effective here unless they secure the consent of life and can use the instrumentation of some delivered energy at its center for a sublimation of the erring human into a divine life force. Now, in this book, The Riddle of This World, the last section is the title of this, The Riddle of This World, and it was written to Maurice Magre, who was a contemporary of Mother and Sri Aurobindo and a writer from France, who was, I think, nominated in either the late 30s or maybe around 1941 for a Nobel Prize in Literature. He didn't win, but he was nominated. What we would probably remember him most for is a book that he wrote called The Return of the Magi, I think is the title in English. And then he was looking at mystical traditions across the globe, from the early times, Apollonius, all the way through the Renaissance in Europe and, in a sense, up to modern times, and bringing out the sense of these secret teachings, the secret oneness that everyone can experience and live from. And somehow, after the publication of that book, found his way to Pondicherry and so was posing to Sri Aurobindo. And the mother, of course, he had many, many conversations with her. But to Sri Aurobindo, he entered into a correspondence in which he asked for elucidation on the major topics of life, like why is there darkness in the world? The question of theodicy, you know, we deal with that often in The Life Divine. And he touches upon it in the synthesis of yoga as well. But there are a number of letters in this section. Here's an opening sentence to the riddle of this world. It is not to be denied. No spiritual experience will deny that this is an unideal and unsatisfactory world, strongly marked with the stamp of inadequacy, suffering, evil. Indeed, this perception is in a way the starting point of the spiritual urge, except for the few to whom the greater experience comes spontaneously, without being forced to it by the strong or overwhelming, the afflicting and detaching sense of the shadow overhanging the whole range of this manifested existence. But still the question remains whether this is indeed, as is contended, the essential character of all manifestation, or so long at least as there is a physical world, it must be of this nature, so that the desire of birth, the will to manifest or create, has to be regarded as the original sin, and withdrawal from birth or manifestation as the sole possible way of salvation. So you see the connection between the paragraphs we've just left behind and in the synthesis and what he's writing here in this letter. I won't read the rest. I'll invite you to explore more of it when you have a chance. We'll come back, though, to this little book, The Riddle of This World, in a couple of moments. In life itself, there is the seed of its own salvation. It is from the life energy that we must get our leverage. For though there is a saving light in knowledge, a redeeming and transforming force in love, these cannot be effective here unless they secure the consent of life and can use the instrumentation of some delivered energy at its center for a sublimation of the erring human into a divine life force. And I cannot find in any other branch of spiritual literature anything so world-redeeming and life-affirming as Sri Aurobindo's approach. Even in the best of the Tantra, this does not exist. It is not possible to cut the difficulty by a splitting up of the works of sacrifice. We cannot escape it by deciding that we shall do only the works of love and knowledge and leave aside the works of will and power, possession and acquisition, production and fruitful expense of capacity, battle and victory and mastery, striking away from us the larger part of life because it seems to be made of the very stuff of desire and ego and therefore doomed to be a field of disharmony and mere conflict and disorder. For the division cannot really be made, or if attempted, it must fail in its essential purpose, since it would isolate us from the total energies of the world power and sterilize an important part of integral nature, just the one force in it that is a necessary instrument in any world creative purpose. Note here that Sri Aurobindo has often written when commenting about art, poetry, etc., that the artist, the poet, must have a large, sometimes even a great vital, through which to find the energy to express the nature of the art, music, whatever sphere you're talking about, even the philosopher must have vitality to sustain the concentration to pour words on a page in some logical sequence that he thinks captures the essence of truth. You cannot connect any of the higher realms to matter without the life force. And the life force is itself a manifestation of Chit Shakti. It is a manifestation of the eternal power of the divine. Life as we know it, vitality as we know it, are emblematic of that. That above, here below. That is Chit Shakti. This is vitality, life, prana, as we call it here. And he continues, the life force is an indispensable intermediary, the effectuating element in nature here. Mind needs its alliance if the works of mind are not to remain shining inner formations without a body. The spirit needs it to give an outer force and form to its manifested possibilities and arrive at a complete self-expression incarnated in matter. If life refuses the aid of its intermediary energy to the spirit's other workings, or is itself refused, they are likely to be reduced, for all the effect they can have here, to a static seclusion or a golden impotence. Or if anything is done, it will be a partial irradiation of our action, more subjective than objective, modifying existence perhaps, but without force to change it. Yet, if life brings it, if life brings its forces to the spirit, but unregenerate, a worse result may follow, since it is likely to reduce the spiritual action of love or knowledge to diminished and corrupted motions, or make them accomplices of its own inferior or perverse workings. Now let's slow down for a moment and talk about this word, which, you know, is a little unusual in English, unregenerate. It means basically unrenewed. It's from the Latin, regenerare, which means to bring forth again. So it would mean to produce anew. And the term in theology, regeneration, means to spiritually renew, to give new life, or to reform completely. So we're going to meet the term unregenerate or regenerated over the next paragraph a bunch of times. So just wanted to clarify that. So let me read this again. Yet if life brings its forces to the spirit, but unregenerate, a worse result may follow, since it is likely to reduce the spiritual action of love or knowledge to diminished and corrupted motions, or make them accomplices of its own inferior or perverse workings. Life is indispensable to the completeness of the creative spiritual realization, but life released, transformed, uplifted, not the ordinary mentalized human animal life, nor the demoniac or titanic, nor even the divine and the undivine mixed together, what some have perhaps fashioned as the centaur image, and other branches of transpersonal psychology. It might be apposite here, to use another fancy English word, to read a bit from The Riddle of This World. This is a letter that I believe was written around 1929, so the ashram was a couple of years old then. And he says here about the ascending and descending movement, the two movements whose apparent contradiction confuses your mind are the two ends of a single consciousness whose motions, now separated from each other, must join if the life power is to have its more and more perfect action and fulfillment, or the transformation for which we hope. The vital being with the life force in it is one of these ends. The other is a latent dynamic power of the higher consciousness through which the divine truth can act, take hold of the vital and its life force, and use it for a greater purpose here. The life force in the vital is the indispensable instrument for all action of the divine power on the material world and the physical nature. It is therefore only when this vital is transformed and made a pure and strong instrument of the divine Shakti that there can be a divine life. Then only can there be a successful transformation of the physical nature or a free, perfected divine action on the external world. For with our present means, any such action is impossible. Well, that gives you a sense. Again, sort of fleshes out what he's talking about from the letter to this chapter. Whatever may be done by other world-shunning or heaven-seeking disciplines, this is the difficult but unavoidable task of the integral yoga. It cannot afford to leave unsolved the problem of the outward works of life. It must find in them their native divinity and ally it firmly and forever to the divinities of love and knowledge. So, in other words, we have to bring into one compass the practice of all these yogas, the yoga of knowledge, jnana yoga, the yoga of love and devotion, bhakti yoga, the yoga of works in life, where we are challenged to transform the very element of life itself, and that is karma yoga. All of them are aspects of an integral yoga, and all of those consummated open the door to the supramental yoga. So we can see how very far we have to go, isn't it? It is no solution either to postpone dealing with the works of life till love and knowledge have been evolved to a point at which they can sovereignly and with safety lay hold on the life force to regenerate it. For we have seen that they have to rise to immense heights before they can be secure from the vital perversion which hampers or hamstrings their power to deliver. If once our consciousness could reach the heights of a supramental nature, then indeed these disabilities would disappear. But here there is the dilemma that it is impossible to reach the supramental heights with the burden of an unregenerated life force on our shoulders, and equally impossible to regenerate radically the will in life without bringing down the infallible light and unconquerable power that belong to the spiritual and supramental levels. So this great life power within us has to be lifted up somehow. He'll get to that in a moment. But until we have suffused it with the supramental power and consciousness, no transformation is possible. We're talking theory, if that's what we're attempting to do. The supramental consciousness is not only a knowledge of bliss and intimate love and oneness. It is also a will a principle of power and force, and it cannot descend till the element of will, of power, of force in this manifested nature is sufficiently developed and sublimated to receive and bear it. But will, power, force are the native substance of the life energy, and herein lies the justification for the refusal of life to acknowledge the supremacy of knowledge and love alone, for its push towards the satisfaction of something far more unreflecting, headstrong, and dangerous that can yet venture too on its own bold and ardent way towards the divine and absolute. So here, this will, power, force, these are all aspects of Chit Shakti, Sat Chit Ananda. So all of these aspects that he's describing here are manifested forms of the oneness of Sat Chit Ananda, none of them distinct from each other, all of them exposing a different power, a different faculty, an attribute, an aspect, a manifestation, a making clear of what Sat Chit Ananda is in its infinite oneness, is achieved through the supramental. The supramental is an expression of Chit Shakti, just as it is an expression of the truth of being, Sat. And the delight and the love that flow from Ananda are also one with the willpower. So if it wants to move vehemently along and achieve its goal, it has an absolute right to do that. It is its nature to achieve, to reach out and conquer. It is that aspect of the will in the supramental that achieves that, born from Chit Shakti. Love and wisdom are not only aspects of the divine, there is also its aspect of power, this Mahashakti. As the mind gropes for knowledge, as the heart feels out for love, so the life force, however fumblingly or trepidantly, stumbles in search of power and the control given by power. It is a mistake of the ethical or religious mind to condemn power as in itself a thing not to be accepted or sought after because naturally corrupting and evil. In spite of its apparent justification by a majority of instances, this is, at its core, a blind and irrational prejudice. However corrupted and misused, as love and knowledge too are corrupted and misused, power is divine and put here for a divine use. And again, we have the greatest record of wisdom recorded in those annals in the field of Tantra. Shakti, will, power, is the driver of the worlds. And whether it be knowledge force, or love force, or life force, or action force, or body force, is always spiritual in its origin and divine in its native character. It is the use of it made in the ignorance by brute, man, or titan that has to be cast aside and replaced by its greater natural, even if to us supernormal, action, led by the light of an inner consciousness which is in tune with the infinite and the eternal. The integral yoga cannot reject the works of life and be satisfied with an inward experience only. It has to go inward in order to change the outward, making the life force a part and a working of a yoga energy which is in touch with the divine and divine in its guidance. Yoga energy, yoga shakti. All the difficulty in dealing spiritually with the works of life arises because the will in life for its purposes in the ignorance has created a false soul of desire and substituted it for that spark of the divine, which is the true psyche. And again, this is touched upon in the riddle of this world. This idea of the false soul of desire does not mislead or distract or delay only the individual aspirant, but as Sri Aurobindo has written about in his essays on social psychology, has seized what seems to be the soul of nations as well at a larger level, and then mistaking this powerful desire element in the national psyche goes careening off to declare its superiority, its gigantic realism, that all should work for me, everybody should make German refrigerators, etc. So, when we speak about this element, it is in universal nature and goes beyond the mere personal into the collective. And it's only when we begin to resolve it in the personal that we can extend the solution into the collective and influence the cosmos in its very fabric. All or most of the works of life are at present or seem to be actuated and vitiated by this soul of desire. Even those that are ethical or religious, even those that wear the guise of altruism, philanthropy, self-sacrifice, self-denial, are shot through and through with the threads of its making. This soul of desire is a separative soul of ego, and all its instincts are for a separative self-affirmation. It pushes always, openly or under more or less shining masks, for its own growth, for possession, for enjoyment, for conquest and empire. He's detailed those above. Of course, he's explained all of this better in The Life Divine, where he can unroll a thought without having to worry about space. Here he's recording notes that didn't get published for another dozen years or so. But the idea is that nature, to help the individuation process along, fabricates something that will support the glimmering presence of the psyche behind. And this fabrication is the ego. And yes, Buddhism and Shankara and everybody else is right when they say that this is unreal, this is not our true being. That's exactly supported by Vedanta, by Sri Aurobindo too. There is a Chaitya Purusha, there is an Antaratman inside, which is the real person. A minute, if you wish to put it that way, spark expressive of the universal truth of the Atman, of the Brahman. And that it is which is the real soul. Not this desire self formed on the frontal parts of our nature or even in the guts of our enginery. That is not the real us. This soul of desire is a separative soul of ego, and all its instincts are for a separative self-affirmation. It pushes always, openly or under more or less shining masks, for its own growth, for possession, for enjoyment, for conquest and empire. If the curse of disquiet and disharmony and perversion is to be lifted from life, the true soul, the psychic being, must be given its leading place. And there must be a dissolution of the false soul of desire and ego. But this does not mean that life itself must be coerced and denied its native line of fulfillment. For behind this outer life soul of desire, there is in us an inner and true vital being which has not to be dissolved but brought out into prominence and released to its true working as a power of the divine nature. The prominence of this true vital being under the lead of the true inmost soul within us is the condition for the divine fulfillment of the objects of the life force. So, the soul emerging from behind has to connect with the true inner vital being, who is the inner warrior described in Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother. And it can enforce the soul's choice and impose upon the matter and link the mind to the matter in a way that is luminous and true. So without the discovery of the true vital, just as we have to find the true soul within us, the yoga can't be done to its completing stages. The divine life power, too, will be a will for growth, a force of self-affirmation, but affirmation of the divine within us, not of the little temporary personality on the surface. Growth into the true divine individual, the central being, the secret imperishable person who can emerge only by the subordination and disappearance of the ego. This is life's true object. Growth, but a growth of the spirit in nature, affirming and developing itself in mind, life, and body. Possession, but a possession by the divine, of the divine in all things, and not of things for their own sake by the desire of the ego. Enjoyment, but an enjoyment of the divine ananda in the universe. Battle and conquest and empire in the shape of a victorious conflict with the powers of darkness, an entire spiritual self-rule and mastery over inward and outward nature, a conquest by knowledge, love, and divine will over the domains of the ignorance. So, possession, enjoyment, conquest, all of it pivotably paced on growth. This is the journey of Agni described in the Rig Veda. These are the conditions, and these must be the aims of the divine effectuation of the works of life and their progressive transformation, which is the third element of the triple sacrifice. So the three elements, again, was first the act engaging with the divine, enjoying the divine being. The second was the symbolic form of the act, and it's being filled with the significance of the divine. And this third is the oneness which is literally fleshed out as a fruit of adoration, of our growing capacity to render all of our being and experiences vital, mental, physical, into terms of self-offering. It is not a rationalization, but a supramentalization, not a moralizing, but a spiritualizing of life that is the object of the yoga. It is not a handling of externals or superficial psychological motives that is its main purpose, but a refounding of life and its action on their hidden divine element. For only such a refounding of life can bring about its direct government by the secret divine power above us, and its transfiguration into a manifest expression of the divinity, not as now a disguise and a disfiguring mask of the eternal actor. So it is a play. It is a spiritual, essential change of consciousness. Not the surface manipulation, which is the method of mind and reason, that can alone make life other than it now is and rescue it out of its present distressed and ambiguous figure. So this is the means to recreate life. When desire leads, life develops into something that can eat and consume its own being, like Rahu swallowing itself in the sky. So this divine life that Sri Aurobindo aims at is aimed at the supremacy of the Supreme Will forging through a self-offered inner vital nature that expresses the power of the soul and grasps and embraces all around into a wide lifting up all our experience of nature into communion back to that from which we come. So it's as if we've gone out and into a basket, gathered all the flowers of nature, and said, here, they're yours. And we feel cascading down the sense of communion because it was received. And we glow even more brightly. So it is this joyful play of nature that Sri Aurobindo aims at. That marvelous expression, what is God after all but a child, an eternal child playing an eternal game in an eternal garden, and your soul is eternal too. So here he's expressed this in reverse order. We begin with the transformation of nature to fulfill the divine will. The Redeemer is redeemed in the end. So I think we can read a section from Savitri, which is very close to this. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3. The Yoga of the Soul's Release, and it starts on page 42. A vision lightened on the viewless heights, a wisdom illumined from the voiceless depths, a deeper interpretation, greatened truth, a grand reversal of the night and day. All the world's values changed, heightening life's aim. A wiser word, a larger thought came in than what the slow labor of human mind can bring. A secret sense awoke that could perceive a presence and a greatness everywhere. The universe was not now this senseless whirl, borne round inert on an immense machine. It cast away its grandiose, lifeless front, a mechanism no more or work of chance, but a living movement of the body of God. A spirit hid in forms and in forces was the spectator of the mobile scene. The beauty and the ceaseless miracle let in a glow of the unmanifest. The formless everlasting moved in it, seeking its own perfect form in souls and things. Life kept no more a dull and meaningless shape. In the struggle and upheaval of the world, he saw the labor of a Godhead's birth, a secret knowledge masked as ignorance, fate covered with an unseen necessity, the game of chance of an omnipotent will. A glory and a rapture and a charm, the all-blissful sat unknown within the heart. Earth's pains were the ransom of its prison delight. A glad communion tinged the passing hours. The days were travelers on a destined road, the nights companions of his musing spirit. A heavenly impetus quickened all his breast. The trudge of time changed to a splendid march. The divine dwarf towered to unconquered worlds. Earth grew too narrow for his victory. Once only registering the heavy tread of a blind power on human littleness, life now became a sure approach to God, existence a divine experiment, and cosmos the soul's opportunity. The world was a conception and a birth of spirit and matter into living forms, and nature bore the immortal in her womb, that she might climb through him to eternal life. His being lay down in bright, immobile peace, and bathed in wells of pure spiritual light. It wandered in wide fields of wisdom self, lit by the rays of an everlasting sun. Even his body's subtle self within could raise the earthly parts towards higher things and feel on it the breath of heavenlier air. Already it journeyed towards divinity, upbuoyed upon winged winds of rapid joy, upheld to a light it could not always hold. It left mind's distance from the truth supreme and lost life's incapacity for bliss. All now suppressed in us began to emerge. Namaste, Jai Ma.